Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Artificial Intelligence, Regulatory and Other Legal Issues: A Primer for Clinical Laboratories. The presenter is Roger Klein, MD, JD, Faculty Fellow, Center for Law, Science and Innovations, ASU Law, Beechwood, Ohio.
Hi, everybody. I think we're at the 1:30 time, so I'll get started. So just a couple of words. I'm a molecular pathologist and also a lawyer by training, and when Robert asked me to do this talk, I thought, well, isn't there something easier, something that I could do? But he, being as prescient as he is, he, I think, knows where the field is going and what the future is, and felt this would be something very important. I will say at the outset that artificial intelligence, as I think everybody knows, is kind of a nebulous term and can be interpreted very broadly, and will touch essentially on much of what we do, and as does the law. And so this is an extremely broad topic that I'm going to try to refine to applicability in clinical laboratories. So basically, we'll start off with a definition of AI for the purposes of this talk, some categories of artificial intelligence, the key differences from other software, because we've been dealing for years in the laboratory with software, and I think the question is what's different here, and how are we going to address issues going forward, and then move on to legal and regulatory issues. And of course, regulatory is a big topic. So what's artificial intelligence? You know, you have these circular definitions by famous artificial intelligence gurus, branch of computer science that studies properties of intelligence by synthesizing intelligence. The science of engineering, making intelligent machines, especially intelligent computer programs. So to me, these are kind of circular definitions that don't say that much that's helpful in a practical way. So I've sort of refined this to, for the purpose of this talk, computer technology that uses complex statistical algorithms and data analysis to solve human problems. And so artificial intelligence is, using that definition, is broad. I mean, it's really computer programs that are complicated and use data and solve problems. And I think, and you can see from this timeline that we've been using artificial intelligence for a long time. I think what's different now is the applicability, and I think that's really the focus of what's here is machine learning, which is the ability of programs to learn. Formerly, instructions were programmed into computers, and basically they followed rules. Now they can teach themselves, or they can be taught, or a combination of both, but they're constantly evolving. The programs are evolving, and what they can accomplish is evolving. And then another subset is deep learning, which is even more intense than machine learning, and then generative AI, which everybody's talking about, which is a subset of all of these, and that's actually the ability, for example, like OpenAI's ChatGPT of actually generating content. So what's the difference between these again? So machine learning was the first step in the first stage of actually teaching programs to learn, to be able to adapt to external stimuli and to teach themselves and to grow. Deep learning builds on that by building more intensive networks. I mean, the official definition, I believe, is a neural network with three layers. So you have layers and layers and layers, and they're meant to simulate the human brain where you, where information is kind of filtered. Layer by layer by layer, and deep learning can get into many, many, many layers. You can get into what they operate on what are called parameters. We don't have enough time to go into all of this, but the parameters, you can get into billions of these parameter values in deep learning. And so we saw AI, and I think what, I guess the difference is, the difference from the primary difference is for these purposes, which is really the legal and regulatory aspects, but I think they're intertwined somewhat in business implementation, is the ability to learn, as said, the use of large, complex data sets. And that allows the recognition of patterns. They can reach conclusions, optimize practices, make informed judgments, and predict future behavior. So these are all things that our software didn't do in the past. The changes in some respects are incremental, but they're different, and they do create different concerns. So if you look at this slide, this represents to me artificial intelligence in laboratories today. We're dealing a lot with software. So we see automated clinical chemistry in the left. We have automated hematology in the middle. We've got a Hamilton robot. There's an LIS system. There in the bottom corner is a lab called Tempus, where their business model is essentially to gather and package data and to manipulate data. They're a genomics company. A microbiology automated system in the middle, and then on the left, that was given to me by Mark Gardner from Quest Diagnostics, and that's one of the new Illumina, the newest Illumina sequencing machines, the NovaSeq X. The point is that software is governing all of this, and it's rules, mostly rules based, but it's complex and it involves lots of data. So what are we going to be doing in the future? And this is why I think this is such an important topic. So all of these things that we're doing, we're just going to build on those. And we're going to have artificial intelligent machine learning type programs are going to improve on everything that you're seeing there. And you're going to have implementation at the organization levels and at the laboratory level. Integration with the laboratory information systems to make labs more effective, more efficient, optimize workflows, lower costs, even work with smaller specimens. You'll have advanced robots. Perhaps these tools eventually will provide genetic and genomic interpretation in a detailed way. They're already doing it. I mean, I was formerly with a genomics company that's now part of LabCorp, and we actually did have a pretty intensive data analysis program. But I think what we're really talking about is the ability to continue to learn from the data. Clinical decision support, external communication with clients, and then moving on to pathology, surgical pathology, for example, image analysis, other algorithmic-based tests that would be, for example, on blood-based materials, and of course, mining all of this information for patterns and trends to improve clinical care and research. Now, that's just on the lab, and I think the lab is probably... The lab is, in terms of the implementation of complex machine learning tools, will come after the business administrative implementations, which create, because you're not dealing directly with patients, create lower risks. And so there is coding, billing, and reimbursement. Network and market insights, marketing and sales, where you get detailed information, for example, about your clients and the products, we'll call them products or services, that you offer, can be informed by the analysis of large data. I think human resources is an area in which these tools are already used intensively and actually can create quite a number of issues. Contracting, you know, you can, it's interesting because in the process of trying to sell, a little off the subject in terms of material, but trying to sell a piece of real estate. And I put you into ChatGPT, give me a contract for real estate sale of a condominium in Ohio. And it printed me in 2 seconds, like this beautiful document. So I think that we're going to see a lot of work in all of these administrative functions that are going to enhance productivity. And then also external communications, and this may be differing somewhat from laboratory, which is really related to patient care, versus kind of administrative and business type communications. So I thought I would just digress for a second. This is really a small area. It's getting a lot of attention, but the AI tests. And if you look at FDA, they say they've approved, I don't know, 800 tests or whatever, including many tests with which you'd be familiar going back years and years. But these tests are different than most of those. The ones that actually use machine learning are mostly radiology. But here's a pathology test. I'm kind of interested. I work with this company through a mentorship program on the upper left, Ataraxis. And they're a spin-out of NYU. But what they do is they scan in a pathology slide. So the pathologist has made a diagnosis. They know they have a particular type of cancer. They scan it in, and they associate the results with response to therapy. And that they're showing internal data shows a 25% improvement over Oncotype DX expressed, which is a gold standard test now for determining or for predicting recurrence and whether or not to give to give adjuvant therapy in localized breast cancer. And I think the point is that these types of tools can detect features that are not visible to the human eye, and potentially you will see some of these types of tests coming into practice. There's one that on the upper right that's already in NCCN guidelines with kind of it has some level of recommendation actually in prostate cancer for whether or not to, for example, add hormone therapy or for prognosis. And that adds some clinical information, but fundamentally it's scanning a slide and getting information out of it that you can that the person can't see. It's something that the machine can do that people can't do, and that the validation of that test is actually, I was speaking of this test at the lower left corner. The one in the right, actually, what they do is the upper right scans the slide and then highlights areas that are potentially malignant, and therefore the pathologist focuses the attention on those areas, and that's actually an aid to the pathologist. And then you have prediction of damage from diabetes using an algorithm applied to some blood markers. The point is not the specific tests, although if anybody's interested, you can certainly look them up. The point is that we are using these tools for tests, but taking individual tests into the lab is an expensive and arduous process. This is a sliver of where these tools are going to fit in and where the implications are for the laboratory, both in operations and in the business contexts. So what are the legal issues? Well, so what's new is when you have this learning program, you have to figure out who's responsible when there are problems. And I think, so among the stakeholders, that are involved, what needs to be done is to sort out responsibility when something goes wrong. And normally, so the first place is going to be through contracts and licensing. Typically, you're going to be licensing these. It's, you know, you either make them yourself or you license them. Most people are going to be end up licensing them. An important focus is on data, both from exposure standpoint and also from a purely regulatory perspective. I think that's going to be a hot spot where people need to be especially careful. There's intellectual property issues. You know, who owns it? If the machine learns, the machine creates data, who owns those data? What rights do people have for them, and can you get sued for what you're doing? Torts. Injury. We'll talk about all these employment discrimination in the HR context, regulation and antitrust, and so, of course, the regulation is a huge part which we'll get to. But even antitrust, which is something that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about, but I think it's going to be important. So as you can see, this is a very big topic, and there's lots of legal issues and lots of minefields. and with technologies that are going to be pervasive. So just starting out in terms of contracts, and most people don't find them that interesting. You know, as a lawyer, so as a molecular pathologist, but a lawyer, people would always give me contracts to review. It's really not fun. You know, you look at the contract, you see all this wording, and it's like not applicable. But it's never going to happen. But I think you need to, people really need to pay attention to these, to what they're doing in this area. So you're either going to develop these products, license them, or some combination of the two. Modification's probably going to be more common than developing internally. It's expensive. You really have to have top flight people to develop these types of programs, at least the complex ones. And so most people are going to license them. And it can be in conjunction with equipment. It can be as services. And then there's going to be licenses with the data agreement usually going back the other way. What can they do with your data? And so you have, and all of, everything presents risks. And so you want to go do your best to sort out the risks as best as possible, to identify them, and then to contractually establish responsibility and potential liability, for problems. And so, And that would go on to the indemnification provision. You know, is the vendor going to cover you if you're, you know, sued for an intellectual property violation, or, you know, for infringing on somebody's intellectual property? And then limitations on liability will probably be in there, mostly from the vendor. Cause so let's say you buy software that uses AI to automate front to rear clinical chemistry lab, and everything that comes in is shunted to different to systems through an AI system, and something goes wrong. And let's say you destroy the samples. So there's injury to the lab, and the lab then will need to be compensated, or will want to be compensated for whatever damages occur. Sometimes you have precious specimens, you could destroy them, it can cause a major problem. We've seen that in certain circumstances. But I think the idea is who's going to be responsible, and it's typically going to be the vendor, unless the lab does something really, really wrong. And the vendor is going to want limitations on liability. So I think there may be for example, for lost profits, you may say, well, you know, we will agree not to hold you liable for lost profits when there's something wrong, but if you destroy specimens or some, you know, you then you are responsible for our business reputation, for the losses we get, and for lawsuits against us. The other issue is getting insurance, and insurance companies are starting to adapt to AI, but it's going to take a while. Sometimes you put requirements for insurance in contracts, in part to provide assurance that the vendor you're dealing with can cover obligations to you if there are any. And then data, as we said, there's issues of ownership in terms of use. We'll get into that a little more. So getting to representations in warranties, and this is kind of what I was alluding to. If you're going to make an investment in an expensive AI system, you're typically going to put it into a critical function. Now it's going to probably start more in the business context, but perhaps, you know, automating laboratory processes, you're comfortable with it, you see something's well validated, well proved. These are really, really important places to use these types of techniques, which potentially improve workflows, and introduce cost savings, et cetera, supply chain, et cetera. And basically what you want to do is you want to look at these possibilities for system failure, and then upfront assess or allocate responsibility for them. A non-infringement warranty is particularly important, we'll get into this, where you're not you want assurance from the vendor that you're not infringing on anybody's intellectual property. And then from a transparency standpoint, you really need to understand the training and the workings of the algorithms, including the representativeness of those algorithms. It's very important, as we'll see in an HR context, it's important for the quality of what comes out of that laboratory. But there are risks to it. You want to make sure, and it goes beyond even bias. The hot spot's going to be racial, ethnic. That's sort of, making sure they're representative for example, in HR, that you don't violate the law. But in general, the more representative what the data are, the better the output of these programs is going to be. They don't really think, they simulate thinking, and they're only as good as what they're trained on. The non-infringement warranty that I mentioned. So typically when you license software, you probably don't even read this stuff. The vendor tells you that they have sufficient rights to allow you to use or benefit from the software. But these systems, because they learn, they can produce their own code. So they can potentially produce infringing code when performing their functions. Generative AI, which the ChatGPT type of AI, can itself create infringing content, or its use may be infringing. And the liability isn't clear for the infringement. These kinds of lawsuits can be really expensive. So you want to make sure that up front that you're allocating responsibility for any of these mishaps that could go wrong, so that you don't get surprised and all of a sudden you're sued and you're in the middle of an infringement suit, which again are very expensive, and the last thing anybody needs just from buying some sort of software. In terms of data use, so typically the data aspects are more straightforward. I mean, we've all had data. Probably most people here have had some sort of data sharing agreements or have been approached, whether with academic medical centers, et cetera. I think the difference here is in these learning algorithms, they learn better and they perform better with more data. So the companies or some of them want your data. They want your data. So you're going to have to negotiate the ownership and the use of data, as well as liability. I mean, this is creating risk because you have your data somewhere else. So assuming, for example, you do allow a vendor to aggregate your data, well, it's possible that on a regional basis or size basis, et cetera, it's possible that competitors could understand, kind of develop, look at it, and kind of see what you're doing, because they can tell that the percentage of the data that's coming from you, and so they can extrapolate. And there's also the potential from competitors just to benefit. Let's say, I mean, I worked for a large laboratory for a while. It's much larger than, say, other labs that I worked in. If they dump their data into a portal, and I'm with a smaller lab, I could benefit from those data. The analysis of those data, and really almost, I don't want to say free ride, but I'm deriving the benefit of insights from somebody's data. So, there may be a reluctance to allow people to allow companies to share certain data or share certain insights. But all of these things should be worked out by agreement. And of course, the amount of concern and the amount of leverage you have kind of depends on who and what you are and what you're talking about. But anonymization is obviously critical to make sure that you can't attribute to data to a laboratory. You want to protect the confidentiality of the data itself, make sure nobody else gets it. And if it's personal data, patient-related data, I mean, this can apply to all sorts of consumer data and everything else. If it's personal data that's health-related, HIPAA, we're all familiar with HIPAA. HIPAA's going to apply as well. State privacy rules and regulations, which are often more strict than HIPAA. But the point is, we don't have like an AI privacy law in the United States. What we have is a bunch of topic related laws and state laws, and you can get into trouble through if you use, for example, if you use this for billing and, you know, data gets out about financial data about people or something, you can, you know, there are laws that could impact that. So it's something that people really need to understand. And again, look at it in the first instance through contract. Intellectual property, we don't have a lot of time, but, you know, you're really talking about patents, copyrights, and trade secrets. I think most of you kind of have at least a general idea of this. Patents tend not to be so great for software because, if the software is really an algorithm, it's not patentable. You have to kind of make it into an invention. And then they take a long time to get. Usually, you know, they may lose value because the information loses value, and then you have to disclose what you probably don't or may not want to disclose. So they tend not to be as good for these unless they're very intimately intertwined with an instrument or machine. A copyright is another way to potentially protect works and source code, etc. It doesn't include the functional aspects. It just kind of it includes the expression. It's harder to go after somebody for copyright infringement to sue them, and they have to copy. There's certain exceptions for fair use, when some of these programs put in open source software, so that can also present some issues. And every time you change it, which you know if you're updating something regularly, where you actually go in and change it versus self-updating, I think that you would have to go re-register it. So that's not optimal either. I think much of this is protected by trade secrets, which is basically things that are valuable that you take care not to reveal. And so basically, you really have to demonstrate an internal effort to protect them and limit access, et cetera. But I think trade secrets in terms of what is actually in there is probably going to be the most prevalent way that folks try to protect some of these fast-moving, advancing algorithms. So the question in terms of ownership, this is really a fascinating area. We don't have time. Every one of these could be a talk. This talk could be a conference, especially for lawyers who get into the details of these. But in general, patents are owned by inventors, copyrights are owned by authors, and trade secrets belong to the entity that protects them, which is kind of easy. But who owns AI-created inventions? Who owns AI-created software? Who owns AI-created data? Well, you can't get a patent on something that's AI-created unless the only way you can get a patent is if there's enough human contribution to make it meet the criteria. So, because a patent has to be issued to a person, and AI is not a person. So, if a machine comes up with something, you just take it and try to submit it. It's really not eligible for patentability because there isn't a human contribution. It's similar in copyright. You can't register copyright on something that's exclusively AI related. If you take that material and you do something to it, you arrange it, there's a human contribution that meets the standard, then that piece you could get a copyright on it. And when you apply for a copyright application to register, you would need to actually disclose the inclusion of those, the AI contributions. But the trade secrets, again, this is, it's clear they're owned by the entity that protects the secret. I mean, you can have works for hire, like in copyright, et cetera, but in general, the ownership inures to the author. Trade secrets, if somebody's working for your business and you have customer lists and you have all these data you analyze and everything, that belongs to the business. It doesn't belong to any individual. It's clear, and there's laws against stealing it. So I guess the fundamental question is who owns it, who has the right to enforce, who can enforce rights. What if there's multiple users, for example, that obtain a software package, and then their data all goes back and they're helping develop and advance it, and then that's an it's infringing is everybody who's contributing to the development of that program. Are they all potentially liable? Again, these are all things that I think that need to be in contracts to protect licensees. The one recommendation also in terms of, so when you're setting, if you have a specific, something specific, a specific application that you're implementing, you can go to a patent attorney, you know, IP firm, and they can give you, they can analyze what's out there and give you a letter a freedom to operate letter, many of you probably have dealt with this in other contexts, but which would give you a risk assessment of the risk of infringement. And then it also is evidence that you didn't willfully infringe, which is, you know, is much more costly, if there's a lawsuit. So, these can be helpful in terms of protecting you as well. Again, include indemnification provisions and license agreements. And even like in training, the use of copyrighted material in training is not yet settled. So you just want to make sure if you're a licensee, you want to make sure that you're protected. If you're honest and you're selling something, you also want to make sure your customers are protected. But I think there is a danger that certain hidden risks could be transmitted to purchasers if they're not paying attention. And these suits do occur. So New York Times is suing OpenAI for its for training on its data. So getting into kind of injury, so we all know software can fail or maybe not work optimally. And so what are the risks of AI? Well, first of all, again, if you involve AI in automated processes, it can malfunction. There can be inaccuracy or non-representativeness, data exposure, data breaches. There's different types of learning, something called unsupervised learning, where you actually don't use data that's labeled, where the AI learns on its own, discovers its own patterns, tends to be less accurate, there's really not a way to measure truth in the same way that you could, for example, when you train it against if you train an X-ray reader or reading algorithm, and you have a radiologist who labels those data first, that's different than if the instrument kind of comes up with it on its own. And so these are risks. And then hallucination, I think anybody who's used generative AI, like OpenAI's ChatGPT, understands that it can make mistakes. So these are risks. And so the question is, if you're a consumer, and I'm really speaking mostly from like the lab perspective of purchasing or licensing these things, one of the areas you're going to look at is at product liability. So it involves typical principles of negligence, where you fail to meet a standard of care, a breach of warranty, which is, again, part of these representations we're talking about, and there's specific laws that address that. And then if something's deemed to be unreasonably dangerous, the vendor can have strict liability assessed where it doesn't matter how much care and preparation they took. If it's inherently dangerous, they can be strictly liable for that. And so what's novel in terms of AI? So product liability would hold any the seller or any part of the distribution chain liable for injury. So again, we were talking about a defective laboratory instrument that destroys precious specimens, software that public releases PHI, software that's hacked and people get control of PHI, or somebody takes a foreign, some terrorist group takes control of some major data center and then major algorithm and then puts things in there that make everything not work. There's all sorts of possibilities. And these are things that I think people need to be aware of. The autonomous action raises new issues. So, like robots, you know, robots can, you know, if you have especially very functional robots, sometimes large ones, maybe you have suppliers, et cetera, they can injure people. And traditionally they've been treated as other workplace tools. And they're rules based, but if they're kind of learning as they go, you know, how do you assign fault to the robot? Is it the manufacturer, or is it the purchaser? And you know, the purchaser is going to want to do that with the robot. And again, these are all things that can be addressed up front by agreement. In AI, the products evolve, so the software can evolve, and it can change the balance of strengths and weaknesses. And that, so one of the risks is that it improves in one area but becomes weaker in another, and maybe there's no warning about that. You know, typically we all get software updates. You know, if you have a computer, you get regular updates from Microsoft, for example, on Windows. But, you know, so any, you know, instruments often have updates that fix flaws, security. And these also offer the opportunity to introduce flaws that weren't initially present as they evolve. Vendors can misrepresent kind of the nature and method of updates, or they could tell you, well, this error, you know, it's not so great at this. This is what the parameters are, but it's going to get better. And then they may fail to follow through on that. And I think because of the overall complexity, you can have unrecognized defects in manufacturing design, instructions, et cetera, warnings that are present. I think it's probably more likely to have those at the time of sale or distribution. Okay, so we're moving on to regulation. So this is very exciting because, you know, everybody's really excited about that LDT rule. But FDA in this area, so this is under the Center for Devices and Radiologic Health. FDA has already addressed, they've been addressing software for years. It's a Center for Digital Excellence, and they've been looking at these areas and now are more specifically looking at machine learning, which is again what we're talking about. They put out, you know, a number of papers, sort of guidance, guidance that the clinical decision support is software support has implications for AI. That's for the regulation of those tools, and that's a guidance. They put out a number of white papers, which I'll show you. But you basically, FDA looks at this as software as a medical device. So you would consider this. You can be software as a medical device means you're not tied to a device. So you're not tied to a physical object. So software is intended to be used for one or more medical purposes that perform purposes without being part of a hardware device. Then there's software in a medical device, which is really the kind of instruments we're seeing and improvements on those instruments. Those are really they're likely to be handled the same way current devices are handled. And then there's software used in the manufacture or maintenance of a medical device. We won't get into that. But I think the software as a medical device is interesting because it's looking at the algorithm or computer program itself as a medical device. FDA's put out a number of these different, guidance, quasi-guidance documents, statements, white papers over the past several years that address, for example, their plan, medical action plan for artificial intelligence and machine learning software as a medical device action plan, good machine learning practices, guiding principles. So they've been working on this, and they've actually been moving ahead, putting things out, and working in collaboration with other centers. So the Center for Digital Health is also working with with CBER, for the Biologic Center, CDER, the Drug Center, CDRH, the Device Center. But they've actually published something saying how they're working together. But really, what they're doing is they're putting together a risk-based framework, as you might imagine, since everything they do is a risk-based framework, tailored to the relevant product. So this is, the philosophy, I think, is similar to what other device regulation is. The difference being there's product lifestyle-based regulation and learning from real-world experience. And so one of the documents that they did that they have put out is, or two of them actually, relate to predetermined change control plans. So that's you can't constantly run back with software to get it reapproved. So what they do is they're putting together a framework for evaluating software that will continue to learn in the hands of the users. So the emphasis is on getting companies, developers, et cetera, to understand where these products are going to go and to put guardrails and that sort of thing. The next agency I wanted to talk about, because we don't talk about this much. We don't deal with FTC much. And they're assigned with looking at deceptive and unfair uses of products, unfair communications. And they've been very aggressive in mergers and acquisitions, and they also have been aggressive in kind of getting into this information game. And it's something to keep on the radar, because I think, at least under the current, current FDA commissioner, the chair, they've been kind of aggressive in looking at some of the privacy, as you might imagine, privacy and then equity and that sort of, sorts of things. And so you can expect scrutiny, for discrimination, potential discrimination, potential privacy breaches, et cetera. As I said, the FTC investigates and stops unfair, deceptive acts or practices. They can get monetary damage. They issue rules. They make reports and recommendations. And they've issued a joint statement with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Department of Justice, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, cautioning that the existing laws do apply to AI. So they're putting people on notice that existing laws do apply to AI. They have a guidance that they issued in 2020 on managing AI consumer protection risks, and then a joint guidance with HHS addressing HIPAA and non-HIPAA consumer health information. I tell you these things because it's a new area and things are going to happen, and it's invariably with these new technologies, things are going to happen. And you have an agency that we haven't heretofore, or most of us haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about, that is potentially could end up bringing enforcement actions or advancing rules that with which people have to comply. Health and Human Services is in the act too. So Health and Human Services is the umbrella agency for FDA and Medicare, et cetera. So those are under HHS. But HHS is here too. They're developing rules and regulations. So there's lots of rules and regulations. Again, this could be a course in itself, just looking at the topics and what everybody's doing and trying to monitor it. It's going to be very hard to try to keep up with what everybody's doing, but it's something that I think we need to do. CMS has their AI playbook, and they're also collaborating with the FTC. So Medicare and FTC are collaborating. So you, just to keep it in mind, that's kind of the way things I think are headed. Medicare Advantage. Now, this is really from the lab perspective. I would look at this more saying what payers are doing in terms of their use of AI. And Medicare Advantage plans have to be able to. They have to offer the same benefits as traditional Medicare. And if they're using AI algorithms and they're not making individual decisions, they could get themselves into trouble. And it could be a ground for challenge if, for example, laboratories are denied payment. So I think it's these types of rules, and looking into this is going to be very important. President Biden issued directives. He's got some executive orders. You know, there's a bit full push for the governmental agencies to move ahead with quality issues and you know, the ability to measure that, but also non-discrimination, equity, safety. So in terms of the HHS secretary, you know, they're supposed to have a task force. I'm not sure if they've done that yet. And then develop these strategies in the health context while promoting innovation and use of AI in drug development. So just a few words about the employment context. You know, I mean, labs are businesses, and it doesn't matter if you're a nonprofit lab or you're a pathology lab or you're a independent commercial lab or you're a hospital, you're an employer. And there are specific prescriptions with respect to how you can use AI in employment screening, hiring, recruiting, promoting. And these programs, they do create a risk of potential bias. And I think the important thing is that there's something called disparate impact analysis. And what it does is it's a statistical look at how the employment profile measures, demographically measures, what's out there in the community. And one of the dangers, for example, in these programs is that maybe they make some sort of association that is not causal, but yet is reflective in a protected class like age, religion, race, sexual orientation, et cetera. And then would start filtering people based on or disability, which would be a common one, would start filtering people. And the problem is you don't really know why. You usually wouldn't know why they made a decision. So it might be very hard to defend, statistical correlations, that you see. And I think what people need to do is they need to monitor this area very closely. If they're using these programs, they need to look at what their hiring profiles are, et cetera, and make sure that they don't get themselves into trouble. Let's see how much time. We don't have much time left. Generative AI, I did want to say this because I know a lot of people are starting to use generative AI at work. That's like, because you can, you know, as I say, I said, I want a real estate contract. It gave me a real estate contract. So people are using this at work to improve efficiency and productivity, et cetera. And what I would urge is policies, whether or not to use it, whether you can use it, and if you can use it, how and under what circumstances. Because people are going to start to bring these technologies into the lab. It's invariable that people are going to start to bring these technologies. If you're not monitoring, you're not watching, you're going to be held responsible or potentially responsible for something somebody does that's violative using one of these programs. So I think it's essential to develop policies for this now for employees to make sure that the use of these technologies that could be potentially associated with the lab, with your company, et cetera, is to make sure that's monitored, regulated, and that you can't be held at fault. Again, privacy is really critical. We don't have much time. You all know about HIPAA. These large data sets that are used to train have inherent risks. They're using much larger data. If something could go wrong, you could release information about people that you don't want to release. And so one of the areas that could be potentially important, if you're going to take somebody's data and you're going to sell it or give it somewhere for them, for the purpose of training an algorithm, I mean, arguably, you can't sell it without consent. So I think people need to understand. It can be very difficult to get patient consent, you know, say, hey, well, I want to take your data and give it to X company so they can train their algorithm, and I'm going to sell it, and you have to tell them, right, and they have to agree to that. That could be a problem. There's GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which prevents discrimination in health coverage, and employment. It really had the Affordable Care Act kind of diminished its importance generally. But now with all this use of data, you know, that's another potential risk. Substance abuse issues, like substance abuse data, are very tightly regulated, and more tightly regulated than HIPAA, as would be like certain protections for diseases like HIV and that kind of thing. Sometimes state privacy laws can be more stringent than HIPAA. So you have to be very careful now with all these data, because you've got huge amounts of data going back and forth between you and maybe an AI company, or they're going to be stored, and you just have to understand that there are risks to it and take precautions. Antitrust, we don't even think about that most of the time unless you're with, you know, kind of in a situation where you could collude. But antitrust could give you, could create, you know, it could facilitate collusion is what I would say, because you can easily monitor what competitors are doing. You could signal price agreements, in certain markets. You could, there's lots of ways that AI could in fact, be used to facilitate anti-competitive, agreements, and there would be a real potential that either FTC or the Justice Department would get involved if they, and there have been actions AI based, but not I'm not aware of health, but people are looking at health very closely, and I'll be surprised if they wouldn't, if this isn't going to be on the radar, the use of AI that potentially results in collusion with respect to pricing. So just to conclude then, artificial intelligence, using machine learning is going to have broad uses, increasingly important roles in clinical research, in clinical operations, research and business operations, and basically all the activities of diagnostic laboratories. Implementation of machine learning and other advanced technologies presents new risks and raises novel legal and regulatory issues. Again, builds on this will build on the previous legal and regulatory experience that everybody already has. But it's going to. But the key difference is in addressing software that has the ability to adapt or that's trained by learning, and it may require new rules and modification of the current approaches. So it's really important to stay on top of it. And again, laboratories and legal businesses are going to need to understand these, the legal and regulatory risks of what they're doing that are presented by the application of new AI potential, understand potential mitigation strategies. So with that, does anybody have any questions? You must have questions, because I have questions, and I don't. It was hard enough with putting it together. It's a big, yes.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.